Welcome to Big Blend Radio's first Friday Toast to the Arts and Park Show with the National Parks Arts Foundation, who are known for their amazing artist residencies in parks across the country. Hey, everybody, welcome. You know we love our first Fridays with the National Parks Arts Foundation, and today we get to welcome back Rick San Nicolas back on the show. He has been on our show a few times, I think three. This is the third, and but he's been an artist in residence at Hawaii National Volcanoes National Park. He's returned there for the fifth time, and so excited to have him back on the show. He's got some updates for us on what has been going on with his feather work. He is a master feather worker, and he's going to remind us all about that. But excited to, you know, five times, Rick. You want to do? Are you going to just move in?
Yeah. Well, no, I'm not going to move in. But you know, being there five times and invited back five times is actually it's a good thing. It's good.
Yeah.
Good thing for me. It's a good thing for the art, you know, and to be able to keep talking about the Hawaiian featherwork and such too. And you know, and even at the lecture I just did Tuesday, now they're calling me the artist. I don't know, emeritus. I think it is for being there five times. And so if that's what it's called, then that's me.
You've got another feather in your cap.
There you go.
I had to say that. That's lame. But I just had to do it. But let's go into this. I know you've talked about it on the shows before, but for new listeners, Hawaii feather work is probably something that people are not that familiar with unless you know, but we've seen it and maybe even not even realize what we're looking at.
Yeah, I guess that's something that with new viewers and such too, that they might want to hear a little bit about that too. But, you know, there's so many other nations that do have feathers incorporated into their work, of course, being the, you know, the Indian nations and all throughout the, you know, throughout the country that they have locations for that. You have your, you know, the American Indians, you have your Indians and the Incas and all the folks in South America and such too, which used all of their birds, you know, but I don't think any of them have used, the feathers and have created and crafted featherwork in the way that the Hawaiians did too. So for the sake of a description, the native Hawaiian featherwork or the ancient Hawaiian featherwork, and that all pertains to, and it's easier to try to maybe reference what people may have seen if they've been to Hawaii and still don't know what it is, or if they're seeing, you know, anything in books about Hawaiians and so forth. And if you've seen any pictures or paintings of the kings and queens, or the chiefs, mostly the chiefs is what you would really reference them to, because when they went into battle, they wore these capes and these big feather capes and the feather cloaks that they had, the helmets that they wore on their head, you know, which were all adorned with feathers of all the native Hawaiian birds during those times and before. And, you know, and during those times that when they did wear them, these pieces were crafted, you know, to go into battle. So you look at them today, and they're really, you know, works of art. And when you see them as works of art in museums and, you know, and whatever other settings that you might see it in, you know, be it on documentaries, you know, that I've had my feather work in on a couple of different documentaries. I've had them on, you know, short films, The Chief of War, the movie series that we're working on right now. But even with all of that work there, you would think that that's what it was, is pretty much art, or it's more so for the, you know, the person wearing it, the ali'i, or the leaders, or the chiefs, kings and queens, as they wore that that's what they were made for, is to adorn them in such a way to, you know, to make a royal presentation. But when in fact, what they were made for is to protect chiefs in battle, and to show that they're, you know, through the colors and through all of the, through all the designs that they had on there were to describe like who, you know, who their clan is, or, you know, who, what island that they're representing, who's trying to be overthrown or not trying to be, who's trying to overthrow one of the other chiefs on another island to try to unite, different, islands under a rule like Kamehameha had done. But, you know, it's all about, you know, then it was about protection. They felt that the capes would, bring them protection as they were walking into battles. You know, the way that they were made were really important, because only certain people, like the priests or the kahuna, those were the people that were the creators of the capes that were making them, although it took efforts of a lot of other people doing the work, like the feather gather the gatherers, like the Kiamunda. Those folks would have to go for, weeks and months at a time to go through the forest to go hunt the birds and take, and collect the feathers and start to bundle them as they're walking and returning and so forth. And so those were long journeys, and those people were really very important in the whole process of it all too. So, with the chiefs that were wearing it, the helmets that they wore, which were all very, I mean, they were just elaborate in the work. And that's why when it came to time that, Cook made his first voyage to land over, in Kealakekua Bay over on the, on this island, that's where, he was first greeted with, the first big collection of feather cloaks and helmets and such too from Kalani Oʻupuʻu, the chief there. And and then, as they say, history is written from that point forward, because that was the beginning of a lot of the feather work being brought off of the islands, although they were gifted in most cases by chiefs and other leaders throughout the communities. That's how a lot of those pieces were collected and not stolen, as a lot of people do talk about. But I think it's everybody's stories in how they were presented as far as the history of it and such too, so people react, differently to that. So it's it, but even at that point right now, and then it started with, maybe coming over, then you started getting trade, and trade was for, well, can you trade me that helmet, or you trade me that kahili, or you trade me that feather cape or cloak or whatever. And that's how a lot of things, changed hands during those times, and even if it was for something like iron nails, or a knife, something that was out of metal, not out of bone, and all those things were intriguing to Hawaiians. And so they were willing to, to give, to learn. And, and at some point it just ended up that where so much of that, feather work was leaving the islands too, which ended up in museums all the way across the world. So.
I wanted to go back to what you were saying about the chiefs when they were wearing them. Like, it's almost like when you look at the Scots and the tartans, the Scottish people have the tartans and it represents their clan, the colors and all of that. So it's kind of similar. But I look at this as a musician. There's your dress sometimes, no matter what you're doing with it, right? You're when you go up to perform, sometimes you put something on, you're like, okay, now I'm ready. It's kind of a I can't it's hard to explain. Like I know like in Nashville, Nudie's does the jackets with all the rhinestone work and all those amazing designs for artists. And I kind of understand where like it's almost like wearing an armor, even though it's a cape. Do you think they felt like it gave them a level of it's kind of a spiritual, psychological thing of confidence going out there, going, all right, this is it. I'm going in. I'm ready.
Well, that's actually what it was, is spiritual, and they would rely on the mana that was tied into the cape as far as the maker. So the importance of the maker being the kahuna, and knowing all of the history of the person that, for example, they're creating the cape for. So as they're doing the work and they have the feathers that are all bundled, and then as the feather bundles are tied on to the fine mesh netting, which is the base of all of the capes, the helmets too, for the most part, and any of the short capes or the cloaks and so on, these feather bundles are made. And as they're tied on, every knot that they're tying onto, the kahuna is chanting, and the chanting that he's doing is chanting the lineage of that person who it's being made
Oh,
for.
wow.
So whichever the chief is being made, now they're chanting all of the lineage from as far back as they can collect from, as far as their knowledge. And I'm sure during those days it was just, pretty much roll off, the tongue of whoever is the one chanting, because of the work and because of who they were, and having to know of the people who, the person of who they're making the cape for, or the cloak in this case, same thing with the helmet. So every time they chant and while they're making knots, they believed that, the spirit of that person, of the name of that, of the families that were in the past, and they probably all, in many cases, were part of different battles and such too, as chiefs, leaders, kings, and high chiefs or lower chiefs, either one, and as they're tied in, that all of those memories built the mana in the cape, which is all of the spiritual part of what they want to, build in that cape. So when that's put on the person of who it was made for, then they feel, walking into battle, that they are not one, but they are many, of a person being their whole lineage is traveling with them. So now they're walking in step with with
Okay.
all of their ancestors,
Yeah.
hand in hand with them. And so they have that biggest amount, of what they can take, spiritually into battle. So with that, and as they go in, and of course, that's the thing that, in battle and then in defeat, then the chief who conquers and who defeats his component, being the other chief king or whom it may be, that's the first thing they'll take, is they'll take their cloak from them. They take their helmet off their head. They'll take their Leini Kokoloa, which is the hair braids that make the lay around the neck, along with the whalebone or the ivory, that in those days, or whether it was coral or whatever, of the Nihopaloa, that the shape of the hook that shapes out, and all of that, because now you've stripped that person of all of his mana. So everything that was made, now you've captured that and you have that power. So when you go into
Wow.
battle, and that was some of the other parts too, when that chief would go into battle again to go into another area to conquer and to take over, so he can start to build his kingdom. They'll go into battle and they'll hold, those other people behind them will be holding up the cloaks, and
Wow.
the helmets and all of the lay that were from there, describing, I have defeated all of these people, lay down now, and then, I'll take over the rule and no one will die, kind of thing. And so, and in other cases that'll happen, and people will lay their arms down and go, and otherwise other places will just say, hey, come after me, let's go, and then we'll
Wow.
fight for it. So even at that, as they collect these all of these awards, or if they collect all of these, the capes as their bounty from battle, what they'll end up doing is that they would never wear them. They would actually take them, and it would actually stay with them as who they conquered and such too. Because if you were
Yeah.
to wear in that time somebody else's feathered cloak or somebody's helmet or even their lei, which has the same as what yours was made of, which is all the mana that's tied into that also, then you would have what their belief was then, is then there would be conflict between your mana and somebody else's trying to fight with you and take over. So
Yeah.
that would be something that they would never do. So in many cases, that when in Cook's time or other ship captains that came over, in many cases, when some of the other cloaks may have been given, some of the cloaks given were most likely there of the belonged to the chief that it was given to, or made for, that was given to the captains. But in many cases, it were a lot of these battle awards, some of the battle capes they collected and such too, that they gave away. So because they would have never worn those pieces
Yeah,
anyway.
you don't want to have everybody else's ancestors on your back,
Yeah,
really, in a way.
and
Yeah.
that's what it was. And I've been, I mean, you can read, and there's very little information about that, but even in trying to research, just picking up a sentence out of a paragraph in an entire book, and that's all it references, little things like that in research are important to know. And then listening to some, listening to the Kupuna and all the old folks that are still with us, that still have their memories of from their grandparents, great grandparents, great great grandparents, and such, to all the stories that are passed down, and sadly, as that generation continues to shrink and fall away, there's so much of that knowledge and history that is falling away, because there again, Hawaiians didn't have the written language and didn't have that history written, so it was always done in the hula, and so even after that, you'd have to search for any information like that through just stacks and stacks of papers about hula, and just to find whatever you can catch of a remnants of a memory that is captured in the hula. So
Wow.
it's getting harder and harder to to partake in and
But
to root
that's
for.
what I think is so amazing with what you do, because it's not very often you have a feather maker, feather worker on our show. It's you, because you've been on there. It's not something that everyone hears and knows about. And I think it's part of carrying a torch too. Do you feel that when you're working on new pieces, you're not putting it on someone that's going to go to war, right? Specifically, but when you're working, are you thinking about all of that history and the people that did wear them?
There's a lot of things, because I spend a lot of time in front of my work. So as far as the, as far as in the traditional way of making, I guess I can say too, which I've said before, but I can say that, in practicing what I believe was done in the time, as far as the physical work of it, mentally, all of that is, is similar to what we're doing. These capes, are not being prepared for battle, like you said, of course, because we're not in that time any longer. But all the time I spend in front of the capes, I certainly do think about, who I'm, especially if they're commissioned work, who I'm making it for, what the purpose is. But other times there's, and I might be just sitting there and working and thinking about different things or parts of my family, my daughters, my wife, my grandchildren, or whatever, about something that's going on, and a lot of times I'll sit there in front of that just the same, and I'm not chanting into that, but I say prayers. I pray for people and such in front of my work. And so a lot of that's captured into, the work of every piece that I make. So, and, not because it would be fitting to say, but it's true, is that when people come by my work, I mean, just most times that where they'll sit there and they'll be around it, and they say the words as, "My God, I feel your mana in this work." And so when I ask them, I go, "Well, what do you mean?" I don't ever pass that part up because I want to know what other people would think. You go, "Yeah, I can feel a lot. There's some I can feel a lot of aloha coming from this work. It makes me want to stand here and look more." And of course, they're always rubbing their arms and going, "Yeah, chicken skin, I got it all over because I can feel that." So if that's, in those cases, I mean, why would somebody say that if it wasn't what they were feeling?
Right.
Yeah. And
Yeah.
so being said and that being true, then, I guess that's probably about the closest I can get to carrying on an ancient tradition by still doing that. But for many different reasons of what would be tied into, the word of mana into, into the work that happens, but it's still in today's sense that really does still, it still plays. And, and if you're doing all these pieces for the right reasons, then it'll affect people in that way. So for me, I'm always thankful to hear things like that because it's just reassuring to me that I'm, doing the work and it's coming out the way
It's
that
energy,
I
no
would
matter
hope to
what.
be.
It's all energy, I want to ask too, how many feather workers are there, do you think, in the world
Well, there's
now?
not many, but what I had maybe mentioned before too, because I am teaching workshops now. I have been teaching. This will be going on like my sixth year of teaching. And so, real quick, 20, 40 seconds. Yeah, I've probably main students. I've probably taught well over 200 students in that time.
That's good.
And then each of them, let's say half of them, that amounts another 100 or so people that were there as far as helpers to each of the work of the students, which have learned, and some of them I've taken on as students after that too. So, and then out of that number, say 300 plus people, there's a good number of people that, that I know that have come through and have made, finished their work, finished their capes and such too. And so, if you're looking at another, say, like 100 people that have really come through and actually finished their capes and working into the next one, and some of them are on their second, third, fourth capes now, in doing the work. And so those are people that I'll focus on in the future for, helpers to me, alakai, or others to learn to try to help to teach, because it's important for me. See, when I select the students, I select them based on what they can do to help perpetuate the art, way into the 21st century beyond my time. So when I'm gone, I know I have others that have been that are going to teach and carry on, all of the work. And even and real quick, and even with that said too, it's not work that was, that was taught to me. This is work that I had to go and learn. So all of my work, which was all through research and all through practice and everything. And it's to the point now that where, yeah, I, my work has been proven to be, done well and accurate to the point that where, I have, like I said, I have several collections in public exhibits. I have a couple of collections in, in museums, in one in Australia, one in Hawaii, and then, and then, private clients and private collections and such too. So I've been able to do that and be able to teach that. So that's what I'm doing. So for the future, whatever we're carrying through is accurate as far as being able to reproduce what ancient Hawaiians had done, but it is my work. So,
Well, where the, and I know that you're in museums and you also work like in film and do a lot on that. And tell us about what's happening with the Museum of the Department of Interior, because isn't that part of a display? Because my thing is, what happens with, your work goes in these museums around the world, right? And You're at the residency again. You're 5 years in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. But with students and other people, what happens with these capes when they make a cape? I mean, that's where I'm trying to for people to understand, because this is a lot of work goes into a cape. You know, this is, and so the magnitude of what you do is it's huge. And like you're saying, you learn all the history, and your students have to have that dedication and the integrity, right, for this.
And they still do, yeah. But as far as through, let's just take that one piece at a time. But as far as their work,
Yes, 10 things at
yeah.
once.
As far as their work and what they do, the main project, which is to build a feather cape, when that project is done, as far as that student on their own, on their time, that remains and belongs to the student. So they actually will keep that. The beginning part of the workshop is a smaller cape, and it's what I would consider a practice size cape. So it's probably, maybe about, I don't know, 14 inches wide, about 10 inches, or no, take that back, about maybe 12 inches tall. And that's for the sake of doing a small project, and then they can get the feeling of, or at least the satisfaction of completing something that's going to be a much bigger project on the next project that they do. But those practice capes I take, and we have the students turn those in after the workshop or after their first class is over. They turn them in to me, and then what I end up doing with them is I get them framed in coil frames. I have them put all of their mana or all of their information, who they are, what island they live on, and then what, learning this art form, what does that mean to them, and what do they see for the future of that? And so I'll take that paperwork that they do with their name and their signature on it. I'll put it on the back of these frames, and then these frames are given back to the nonprofit group that funds the workshops. And then for them, they actually give those, as their gift to others that that might donate to the nonprofit for for other classes, but mostly for funding for the the workshop teachings and everything for this workshop too. So that's what will happen to one piece. The original full-size cape that they make, they'll keep for themselves. And in a lot of cases, the classes that I might teach and such too might be some of the royal societies, like the Royal Order of Kamehameha. I have several students or many students that are part of that organization. And and part of their liana and their thing is to, in public, of course, is to wear their capes. Whereas in the past, they've all worn capes made out of material. It's just cut and and how they are made, then you put them on and that's the deal. Well, and then today, since, ever since I've been doing feather work, and when I started to teach, those were one of the main goals, is to be able to teach within some of these societies so that we can get them out of these, material capes and get them into real feather capes, because now there's somebody who knows how to make them. There's somebody who can teach that. And so the reason of, so then at that point, for the reason of not wearing a real feather cape is because you're choosing not to, not because there's not a source to learn from. So through that group, like the Royal Order, through another group of Mama Kakao, which are the sons and daughters of warriors, that's an organization that's out there. Halinawa, there's probably three or four different, or four or five different groups that have that. And so I'm right now working and teaching within some of those organizations now, or students that, and even where they actually are starting to wear the real feather capes. And so if you ever see that, yeah, when you see that out in public, when they have the real capes, it commands attention. And no matter what's going on, we walked through doing a installation of one of my new feather cloaks at one of the hotels that we're going to be exhibiting that. And walking from one point out of the, out of everyone's eye, there was chanting going on by the person leading in the entourage of the Royal Order, myself and the rest of the members coming into this. And so as soon as the chanting comes, people will start to listen. But when, all of the chiefs came down, and I believe there was eight, myself and yeah, probably just eight people, but with real feather capes on, and all the music that was going on outside, and all the restaurants that were open, that were, that we walked past and everything too. I mean, it just was almost to a silence that where people would watch and see that, because it does that. It really commands attention. more so too with real feather capes on. And so people don't see that, you don't see it at all.
Right.
And so now it's starting to happen. And for the groups that have it happen, I think it brings more attention to them. And so it brings them back into the public's mind, about when things like that do happen, that maybe they are going to pay more attention, listen more, and see, what it is. And it's the same, when real pieces like that are put up, like just like in exhibits, when I set up a big exhibit that where I might have 10 or 20 feather capes out on exhibit, that it just commands attention and people will stop and they'll come over and look and they want to learn. And that's the whole thing is to get people to get involved, and get them to want to learn more, at least, to be asked questions and to learn that way. But that in that case, a lot of times what will happen is I'll end up getting people to inquire about classes and how they want to, that they want to learn, not just to say, they want to learn, because I'm not really interested in teaching people that just say, hey, I just want to know how to do it, because it's a real big expense in order to be a student in one of these. It's thousands of dollars per student based on, just materials. And then, of course, for anything else as far as time and such too, for me to be there, so having the real feather work tells the stories. And so when we talked about documentaries and films and like Chief of War, Chief of War, really on that, I was hired as a consultant. So I'm the feather consultant for all the feather work that's on that show, and so for doing the work and teaching them, how to present, feather work in such a way that it's certainly, that will enhance the whole movie, and seeing the feather work in, in the field of battle and things like that. It's my gosh, it's so spectacular. I just can't, I can't wait to see it. I've seen it, in as it's being filmed, but when it comes to a big screen, I just can't imagine what it's going to look like, because it's done on such a big scale, and Chief of War, that's the movie series starring, Jason Momoa, playing the character of Kayana. And Kayana is one of the first chiefs that were out about to travel around the world, from Hawaii. And he was the one that was the first to bring back things like weapons and gunpowder and places from when he traveled around to China and to, the Philippines and all the different areas. And so, and he became almost a favorite person when he comes back, because now all the other chiefs want to, probably want to talk with him and say, hey, what do you got? And, and be
Trade
able
it
to,
up.
and be able to gain from that. And so even in a short film that I had done, which already has had its premiere and it's going on a tour right now through the movie, like the Cannes Film Festival and some of those, the movies that they, or the, for the short films and such. And it's called Kukini. And Kukini, which is another film about Hawaiian history, but any of this stuff now that's starting to come out about Hawaii's history is really important, because nobody is, I mean, the stories that have been told in the past, like, the movie Hawaii in the 1970s or some of the movies from the 60s, it's all about more, that's more commercialized. You see a lot of the hula in those days, and and then Hawaii is really about coming there and you receive flower leis and you get to watch hula, you get to hear music, and nothing like the stories that these are being told right now, which is part of, the history of the of these
The
movies that
actual truth, the
come
roots.
forward.
From the tourism side, I know we work with a lot of travel writers who are covering Hawaii, and they're having to like, whoa, okay, wait, we can't, this is not, this is what needs to be portrayed. The true stories, the history, the culture, the heritage, and we're seeing a big shift happen for Hawaii, which I think is good because it got, like you said, this commercialized kind of thing that is that went away from who the people are of the islands.
And what the Hawaiians had to go through in those days and such too, as far as how, they became under one rule. I mean, there's so many stories that are going to be told, but the biggest part about telling it is the accuracy of what everything is going to look like. And so, my, of course, being partial to feather work, but my, that was my biggest part about talking with anybody, is about what the feather work that they're going to use, if it's going to be real, or if they're going to try to put something together that's going to look like it was tried to put together. But, the efforts that the people are making now to be a part of that and to tell that story are really, I mean, they've grown so much. Chief of Board, all of the work that they did on that as far as their research, they did their due research on this.
That's
So
awesome.
when that story begins and when it comes out, it'll be on Apple TV and it'll be a movie series. And so it'll be, I don't know how many episodes it'll be, but it'll be several episodes that will come out telling a story. And then at the end, it's certainly going to be, you'll be wanting more because there's so much more to tell. And so, but for me to capture the audience and especially the Hawaiian audience, which is what you're doing, they're telling Hawaii's history and you're going to be graded on,
Man, you
how
better get
accurate.
it right.
Yeah. You're going to be graded on how accurate your stories are. And
Yeah.
there'll always be people that are going to say, no, that's not right. There's always going to be the naysayers. There's always going to be the people that are going to be, always a part of, yeah, that no, they're doing it right. But you know what? The one thing is that no matter who or what side of the fence you're on about believing or not believing, whether it's true or not true, I think they're all going to watch this. They're all going to watch any of those movies that when they come out because they want to see. And I think what will happen is that if all the folks that are going to be doing these things, like the short film Kukini, and that was another one, and that's already been previewed. I was there in Honolulu for that preview, and it was, even being a short movie, I think it was 21 minutes long. The first film festival they went to was Maori Land, which is in New Zealand. And watching the TV interviews after that, listening to everybody as far as their commentary and what they were talking about in as far as the people, all the characters or the not the characters but the announcers and stuff and listening to their words. It was just like that was just a huge, huge hit, and they can't wait to see more. But even with that, they used actually my feather work in that. So they used a feathered cloak and a helmet, a couple of different capes, another couple of different helmets and such too. But seeing it on the big screen, and even though once again I was there during the filming and you watch it, well, when you're watching it happen, for me, I mean, gosh, I live around this every single day of my life. I have in my studios like a small museum. I have feather work everywhere, and so it's no big deal. But when you see it on the screen, that's what is going to be the big, that's going to be the big part that's going to capture the people is just seeing that. So when you follow along the storyline and when it comes to a point where, the chief or the elite are supposed to be in their feather work. And when they do see it that way and with the real feather work, it's, I mean, that's the look is like, oh my gosh, wow, what am I seeing? And so the efforts that they're all putting into this are spectacular. And, for me, I'm proud of the effort that all of the people that I'm working with have put into making sure that they tell the story correctly. And they're going through, I mean, all the cost of what it takes to make sure all of that happens. And so, for that
That's
particular
awesome.
award, when it comes out, I'm so excited for that. When Kukini, that movie is done with all of the film festivals and when they do start to show it, publicly in the just in between, maybe it'll be as a precursor to a longer movie or what have you. But when that does show, and then all the different venues, maybe like on airlines or whatever, I don't know. But even that one is going to be something that's really going to be to do. And I know that there's other films that people are talking about doing in the future, and near future. And when those films come up and when those films happen, now they do have the source. As far as for at least the learning part of the feather work and to do it correctly to make that showing, because that's what the Hawaiians will do. That's what I'm going to do. I think that's what everybody does. People that don't know anything about Hawaiian history or about feather work, they'll watch it. And if it wasn't real feather work, they'll go, oh, that's really pretty. But when the Hawaiians see it and everything too, they go, yeah, first thing they'll see is that that's fake. And so, your level of what you're watching, is pretty much going to go from that. And then you're just going to try to listen to the story while you're criticizing everything. So for me, that was a big part of it. And now I think that anyone in the future, which again, there are others that are going to come. And when that does happen, they're all going to be using the real feather work because the precedence has been set
That's excellent
and you can't
because this
go backwards.
reaches the masses. I wanted to ask about, I mean, I know exactly there's, I know we've talked about this before. When we lived in South Africa, there was a TV series made on Shaka Zulu and it's Shaka. And then there's a movie made. And I always tell people, don't watch the other movie. It's trash. It's like when it, because it's not historically accurate, but when they, and Henry Selig, and he's gone now, but, this was so accurate and done so w with that integrity. That word to me is so, it was it moved you. It got you to understand, and this sounds weird, but the supernatural power of being a warrior, because there is a supernatural thing that happens. And I can't explain it, but Shaka Zulu was one of the best warriors on the planet. I mean, he nailed the British bad, and he did it well. sorry to the British, but it's true. But and they also feathers and ostrich, and I know we've touched on that, but so you're really right about setting that precedence. And it was filmed and done in South Africa with South African actors, and it was done correctly. And I think because it's a series, you know, a movie can be one off, but a series, you're going to, like the second episode, you're already going to get flack from people if you did it wrong. So you
Right.
really have to, you know, keep going. So I love that part of it. But now when you talk about feathers from history and into now, I know I touched on that before, but again, so people understand where you're getting feathers. And then I have a question about how you were talking about the helmets. How are you applying? I mean, I want to watch it at some point, how you do it, but how did they apply feathers back then? You're saying tying, but to a helmet, because like our minds may go, first thing is you're gluing them on, and that's probably not what's happening.
That's
So
like ever, no.
I know, it's like, hell no. No,
no, but you know what, you're right, because most people will have no idea how that's, you know, how that's applied and such too, you know. And even in looking at the part about you know, the feathers that were used, of course, Native Hawaiian birds all were used for all of the ancient pieces and such too. So for today, you know, even in my case, and so what I use pheasant feathers. And so the pheasant feathers, and I use as close as a match to colors. And I think we've matched pretty much everything of what we've done as far as my work goes, that are as close as they can be. And I think the confirmation of that too is that the, you know, the masses that do see the featherwork, and still today up till, you know, Tuesday night, and even at Mary Monarch, every time I bring out new featherwork and a new feather cloak and such, that they all think that these pieces are old from the Bishop Museum, or, you know, where did this come from and what's the story? And, you know, so all those kind of questions are asked. And then for me, that's probably the biggest form of flattering that I would be able to get or confirmation, is that, you know, people think that it's very old already, when in fact I may have just finished that cloak 2 months ago or just yesterday. Either way, you know, and so using the natural feathers and everything in trying to give it the look of, you know, the age that is already been there. So you might think that this cloak is already 300 years old or 400 years old, depending on, you know, the story that you're trying to tell, because a lot of these pieces that I would make, or would design so that they could be made for a movie, that, you know, it would really have to, you know, it has to show that look, and it has to show the age look. And so we're able to do that, or at least I'm able to do that when I do my feather work, with using natural colors and natural feathers. They're certainly harder to work with than a dyed feather, of course, but, you know, I started my first pieces of feather work I made were two helmets. And then come to find out afterwards, everyone was going, holy smokes, that's really hard, you know, because helmets are way harder to make than a feather cape. So,
yeah.
And then for me, I was going, yeah, that's why it was easier when I started to make the first feather cape. Once I figured that out too, then, you know, that was, to me, it was easy to do, you know. But I did a partial cape, which that was the purpose of making it, was to show, you know, the netting that's behind and everything. And so all of the work that's put together from that. And that was the only one I ever used a dyed feather on. Everything else I've used natural feathers on. So, yeah. So when you talk about like the helmets and how they're made, or the capes are all the feathers. And when they're, after they're prepped and bundled, they're all hand tied onto and knotted onto the small mesh the fine mesh netting. So the netting that I use in some cases are, so every knot that the diamonds that come along, if you would see on net, every knot is like a quarter inch apart. And that's how close the feathers are. Even one that I'm working on now, which is a little small, but it's like 1/6 of an inch apart. So, but the quarter inch is pretty much what, you know, the Hawaiians had used. And of course, they didn't take the netting from a big bolt of netting like I do.
Right.
Of course, they had to sit and create and make the net from plant, and take the plant to Olana, plant and strip them, pound it down and strip it all down to clean the fibers, get all the fibers off. And then from that point, you start to make a twine or a thread. And from that point, you make it into a bigger twine.
Oh my gosh.
Then you take all of the miles of twine that you've made, and now you're going to make your net. So you have to make the net for a cloak, whatever size that that's going to be. The battle cape, whatever size that's going to be, which is shorter than a cloak, but the cloak goes from, from the neckline all the way down to mid-calf on a full size,
Oh.
man, as far as the chief, that it was made for, or the ali'i that it's made for. In most cases, just from the neckline, right at the back of the neck down to the bottom of the calf is about 58 or 60 inches. And so from that, then you can really gauge, and when people talk about how big the Hawaiians were and the Hawaiian men that were going into battle based on that. And mid-calf that the cloak would fall. So you take the inches that you would get from there, which in many cases is probably 14, 15 inches in most cases from that. Then you have the neck to the top of the base of the head to the top of the head. And so from that you can gauge, and most of them
Wow.
were all in that 6'7", 6'6", all the way up to 7 foot
Ooh.
tall, that would be. And so that's why, the pieces that are made and how they're made and such too, that they were made, specifically for, for a person. And so the same with the
That's a lot
helmets. The
of work.
helmets had to have been woven first. So you have this basketry that's done underneath, which is really intricate. And that is made from vines, the iei plant. So it's the long vines that grow down. And as a reference, you could think about rattan, and that's basically the same thing.
Okay.
So the roots are round, hard. They split down the middle, the aerial root, and then it splits over. So it's like a half moon shape, but they're not really, of course, big, but that's what you want when you're sitting there weaving. And so once that's woven, then the same netting that's used for the capes are cut into pieces, and they're applied onto the helmet, to create a grid in order for you to tie feathers onto. So it wasn't like when they were weaving the helmets that they were tying feathers into the weave. No, because there's really not a physical way to make that happen. That's why the netting is applied over the top, to that. And then one other older method that was done, which were to take braided, like braided sennit, or using something like a kapa, and there were twist long lengths of kapa that were, then they would tie feathers onto that to make like braids of feathers. And then
Wow.
these braids of feathers are lined up and made specific rows to the side of the head, specific rows in order on the other side. Then they would have to be put together, and then those are applied onto the helmet. So there's no netting on that, and then onto the side of the crest, on the top of the crest, and on the front of the face and on the back. And so it's a, it, you know, the work is beautiful, but it really is a really intricate art. And, I can say it's easy because, of course, it's easy to me, but I try to teach it in a way that it's as, can be easy to others, but in the learning part of it, it's all about repetition, and it's about, doing one thing thousands of times. Or in the case, like of a feather cloak, it's like doing feather bundles and making 68 or 70,000 feather bundles and making 70,000 knots. And then when you apply these bundles onto a cloak, then you're making 70,000 more knots to tie them on, and include throw in another 800 or 1,000 knots to do, border work and things like that, and putting the net together and what
And you
have
have
you.
to keep your head together because it's repetition, and repetition can, mess you up. Because I know that even from jewelry making, you get, or even knitting or quilting, you get so used to the repetition and you're in the
Right.
zone, and you go over a few and you've messed up. You were supposed to turn right and you didn't. And then you have to undo and go back, and it
Right.
sucks. And so there's a patience level because you kind of still have to be alert through the repetition. Right.
Well, it's 100%. Yeah, you just have to let it take you where it takes you. When you talk about being in the zone, then you stay in that zone as long as you can, to do that. And I, and with my work, I'm, I do that 12, 14, 15 hours a day,
Yeah.
easy. I mean, but it's not, to where I'm just buried in what I'm doing for 15 hours a day. I still do plenty of other things throughout the day, but I don't, use the time to like sit and watch a movie. Sometimes I might, but if something comes on, it's a movie, I'll sit and, watch it if I want. But otherwise,
Better
it's
have
just
your feather
background.
work in it if you're
Well,
gonna watch
it does,
it.
because then it becomes background noise to me, and I'm still watching as I'm working, but with all of that. But then again, when you get into the zone like that, it's very therapeutic. It's something that really, really it's good. It's good for you, and it heals a lot of things too. And so even in my workshops when I teach, and I teach that, and I tell people to let that happen, and then I started focusing last year, and then in this year's funding, I'm working on this too. But I've been working with people like first responders, people that are, some of the youth that
Okay.
are in organizations and so forth to, to correct, some just bad decisions in life and what have you. But, with first responders, that was a big deal. I've been working with
That
several
is.
firefighters, in Federal Hawaii, Federal Fire, Firefighters Union. And, because people like that, be it, a firefighter, a police officer, ambulance, police officer, detectives, whatever, but when you're going into work, and more so for the first responders, I mean, that's what you're doing. You're pretty much know you're going to work and it's going to be a shit day one way or the other. It's going to be because there's going to be a tragedy that's going to happen. Not having it happen, those are great days. And then, but you're still mentally dealing with the trauma of other things that might happen. And especially with firefighters, and that's why I started with them, is the fact that, I mean, even a car crash, and then a car crash is going to have somebody, definitely injured in there. Same thing with ambulance drivers, but they have to deal with it. They have to put the fires out. They have to get the people out of the car, the jaws of life, got to cut it open, get people out to save them. Car goes off a cliff, I mean, drop to 400 feet and, fires at the homes. I mean, it's just dealing with it. Even if you don't lose people, you're dealing with the tragedies of what people are going to be going through. And so with feather work and such too, as I start to teach that in those types of groups and organizations, is to take your mind and give you something different, than the stereotypical way of dealing with stress, which might be drinking or might be drugs, or then, and if you're done with that, and then by the time you go home, then just being with your family could be stressful for you. And then it ends up, being that where it might be something along the lines of, physical abuse or mental abuse at home. And so instead of doing that, then I'm just trying to give another way into where you can really get something that you can actually work within, work with something like this as projects. You can actually work with the family in doing this, and it'll be something that's still therapeutic to you and something you can do together, your family together, and work together
Well, it's
on things.
high in end coordination too, so it's it does a mental shift on your brain. Like they've done science of like actually physically doing something, right? That kind of and repetition where your brain allows like music like if someone's like I can't sit still, I'm not good at that, I'm not, but if I have something to kind of do something, I can sit still, but I have to fidget with something. That's just me. I'm just a, but if I'm into a zone like that, I'm in 100%. I'm not fidgeting. I'm in, I'm locked in. I mean, I've caught myself doing some kind of craft work or, and next thing you're so in the zone you're drooling. So don't tell anybody that. I didn't say that on this podcast, but it's true. But it helps because it does shift your there's a neurological thing that happens with your brain, and it's where everything in your body is working in tandem in one zone, and it's meditative, it's calming, it is healing, truly physically, mentally, spiritually, emotionally healing. It's a fantastic thing you're doing with that. Now, tell us about this exhibit for the National Park Service. What is happening?
The exhibit, as far as for the Department of
In what?
Interior. Oh yeah,
Yes.
well yeah.
Yeah, the
So
Department of Interior. Yes.
yeah, so
Get
they
my
have.
agencies correct before I get in trouble.
I know you just threw me off guard there. I'm going like, oh, what exhibit? I don't have one.
Yeah, you got a new one you just didn't know about.
Something I have to put on my calendar. But yeah, there is a feather cape that was sent to the Department of Interior. So. And through their request and such too. So it's, it's a yellow, yeah. So it's a yellow cape with just a multicolored border on it and such in a koa frame. And it was requested for the Department of Interior Museum. So after going through all of the federal paperwork you have to go through in order to do stuff for the federal department, that my cape was sent out to them and it was received. And then when it was received, it was put into the museum. And then, people were starting to view it and such too. So, but the funny thing was, after it was put up on the wall there, that I was told and contacted by the museum curator, and then of course with Tanya, with the National Parks Arts Foundation, she would go, "Oh my God, Rick, you don't even know what happened." I go, "Well, of course I don't know, so you have to tell me. So what happened?" And she goes,
That is
"The
Tanya.
yes, I know." So. She says that your cape was taken out of the museum, and it was put the Secretary of the Department of Interior, Deb Haaland, she requested for that to be put in her office. So of course they picked it up wherever it was in the museum, put it in her office, and now my cape resides in her office right now. And even to this week is when I heard more about that too, is that when they do tours of the museum, she has them start in her office so that they can show her, or not show her, so she can show whoever's on this tour the feather cape first in her office. And of course, she says hi to them and such too, but it starts in there and then it goes back out to the
Wow.
museum, and they go through that too. So for me, I was like, wow, that's
That's
really cool.
cool.
That's pretty exciting too. And then of course, not sooner than a week or so later, after it's probably a couple weeks later after I was told that it was in her office, that I get in the mail a handwritten note from her saying that I have your cape and it's in my office now, and I can't tell you how happy I am and so forth. But and I guess it just really brings a lot of joy to her to have that in there, because right now it's there and I don't think anyone's going to be able to get it to move out of her office at any time soon. So and that's really rewarding, and in just small little ways like that too, where even people of high federal status in cases like that, that can enjoy your art in such a way that they can make somebody take it out of their museum and put it in my office because I want it there, and so
I
it
wanted
was,
I yeah,
yeah,
because like
I know. And
that's
it
awesome.
was just fun. It was just good. It was really cool to hear, and then she's trying to make, or we're trying to make arrangements. And one just fell through because of timing, but we're trying to make arrangements, because she's requesting that that she wants to meet me
Cool.
and to be a part of that. And then part of that journey over there for this meet and greet and such too, is to meet with the museum also about creating an exhibit that they can actually show in the Department of Interior Museum there. And so of course, that got out, and then all of a sudden I'm talking with the Smithsonian about another project, and he goes, hey, I hear you're coming over to do this and talk to these guys next door. So if you do, make sure you call me. And this is the curator over there at the Smithsonian, and says, yeah, come over. I'll take you through my vault. My vault's way bigger than their vault. And so,
You're
and
having a
then,
vault off. I know. I
yeah,
love that.
right. And then they're talking about, maybe doing an exhibit there at the Smithsonian too, which those are both really, those are really big
It's
things
prestigious. That's that's that
about things
means
like that.
it's wonderful because it tells, a big part of the history of Hawaii and the people, and
Right.
keeps and that I think it's important. I like this change of how things are being done, and I think Deb Haaland has done so much. I think we're doing better on our parks through
Right.
her and our
That, and
lands,
that
I
is really,
think.
and that's good. And it, and you know, and just from the standpoint, from an artist point of view, those kinds of things to focus on, in whatever way that it might be, is it's important too, because actually, about a month or so ago, I just did an interview for the Smithsonian. They had contracted a couple of people in Hawaii to do interviews, and what they're doing is that they have put out to, as far as the interviews, they wanted to interview who they felt were masters at the Hawaiian crafts of what they, or what are all considered, very worthy art forms and such too of Hawaii. So I was asked to do an interview because I was selected by the Smithsonian to do that part about, of ancient Hawaiian featherwork. And so I did an interview with that, and this will be part of the, and they're doing these so that it'll actually just to document, and it'll be part of the archives at the Smithsonian Institute.
Oh,
And then
nice.
when that happens, I think you'll be able to probably just at that point, until they do something different, to be able to listen to the recordings. There's a lot of questions and answers about, the craft and the work and how it affects, wine history and so forth. But those types of things will be available on the website, and then even at the Smithsonian, if you're going into any kind of a collection room or whatever that might have the featherwork of Hawaii, which is in their oceanic, I think it's their oceanic collections and such too. So there'll be something like that that'll be available to see too. So, and even something like that. I mean, those are small things, but those are really important things, you know, I feel. And certainly to me, it's quite an honor to be selected for something like that too. So.
That's awesome. I love this. How has it been being a fifth resident, a fifth year residency, like a fifth time with the
Oh yeah,
National
you
Parks
know,
Arts Foundation?
I
They are
know.
awesome. I
They
love
are.
them.
The first day here, I think I went out and played golf. So that was my first day,
Shh,
you
don't
know,
tell
everything.
anyone. Did you
Oh,
wear a
she
cape?
knows.
A cape? Yeah.
She knows, yeah,
Yeah.
because that's where, you know, I am right at a golf course too. So, but you know, and that's one of the things that I've been working on, you know, and I'm just about finishing up a cape I started when I when or I started earlier before I got here, but I brought it with me, and I'm just about finishing up with it here right now too. And I brought other work, you know, to continue on with a little bit more while, you know, while I'm here. Because from here, I think I'm leaving on the, yeah, I leave on the 24th. And from here, instead of going home, I'm going to Oahu after this. So I've been here since the first of the month for the Merry Monarch Festival. That was the first week, 1 through 7 or 1 through 8. And then I was here on the 8th until the 24th. And then I'll head to Oahu. I have workshops to teach over there. And then after that, then I'll be heading back home on the 30th. So yeah, it'll be a long month traveling. And of course, you're sitting there going, what a baby. That's all I do is travel, you know, so because my time,
Hey,
30
no.
days away from home, that's a long time for me.
No, I mean it
You know.
is. It I no, it really is, 'cause it's like a, you know, you yeah, and you have to get ready to travel, and that's the hardest part, is getting ready, and we're always having to get ready. And we thought being on the road
Right.
full time would get that part out, but it's not true. You're always
No.
getting ready. So no, I love it. I'm glad you went back and continuing. I mean, you know, look at all this success. It's just amazing. I think we talked almost this time last year, and look how much has happened in a year, right? It's amazing.
There's a lot of stuff that happened between the time you and I talked last. Yeah, there's an
Yeah,
awful
a
lot of
lot.
things going on. Yeah, and I don't think this time from now until Merry Monarch next year and after. You know, I mean, there's a lot on my plate for that too. So I have a big, actually, I have a really busy year this year coming up, or at least I'm in the busy year right now. So there's a lot of things that are going on. They're all good, you know,
Yeah.
and all of it to, you know, to perpetuate, mostly it's perpetuating the art, teaching the art. And so, yeah, it's a lot of good things that are going on right now.
That's awesome. Everyone, keep up with Rick at HawaiianFeathers.com and the National Parks Arts Foundation at NationalParksArtsFoundation.org. They are amazing. These kinds of residencies where artists can spend a month in a park. It's just something so beautiful and unique everywhere, from places like Hawaii Volcanoes National Park all the way to Chaco Canyon up in northern New Mexico. Just a lot of unique experiences. So if you're an artist, be like Rick. Be five times. Get in there five times, you know. And well, it's like, you know, Alice Lees, she's like that too. I mean, there's artists that just, and you know, you can apply. Sometimes you don't get through, but just keep applying. Don't stop. Go for it. It is truly a unique experience. And you wouldn't go back for number two, three, four, and five if it wasn't,
No,
you know.
that would not have, yeah, because it's very motivating being in places. And in my case, it's always at the Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. You know, it's a very motivating place. If you let the land and your surroundings, you know, motivate you, you know, in whatever media of art that you do, you will be, because there's so much that's here to see, and there's so many different things in one small area, you know, and you know, living land. The land is changing. There's a live volcano up here, you know, and so many times that the volcano has erupted, earthquakes that happen, you know, fissures that will crack open a little bit larger and such
Yeah.
too. And next thing you know, it's a red mountain waterfall that's coming down. And that's what you know, I mean, just things like that from any artist standpoint are really motivating, you know, to all of the medias. And so, yeah, just keep trying. That's what you do. And, you know, if you get selected for something like this, it's very rewarding, and you should just go for it because it's a lot of fun. You'll enjoy it.
Thank you so much, Rick. It was a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure talking with you again, and hopefully we'll do this again another time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for joining us here on Big Blend Radio's First Friday Toast to the Arts and Park Show with the National Parks Arts Foundation. Learn more about their amazing park artist residency programs. Go to NationalParksArtsFoundation.org. Keep up with our shows at BigBlendRadio.com.